Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. The Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a neurologist who practices at the Mayo Clinic. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, we focus on back to school with a professional health coach who joins us to give us tips for an easier back to school transition for both kids and their parents. And later, how do we solve global health problems? Our guest tells us one by one by one. But first, as the summer sun wanes, the anticipation of a new academic year stirs a whirlwind of emotions, both thrilling and daunting. We all know that back to school time is an emotionally charged, stressful time for everyone, students, parents, and teachers alike. As the school bell chime and hallways come alive once more, we're joined by a seasoned health coach to navigate the dynamic landscape of going back to school. From fostering resilient routines to fortifying immune-boosting habits, our health coach imparts a holistic toolkit for a successful academic year. So whether you're a curious student, dedicated faculty member, a caring parent, prepare to be equipped with expert advice that transcends the classroom, promoting a healthier, happier community overall. Alejandra Ruff is a local professional health coach who joins us now with tips on how to navigate this tricky period. She is the founder and president of Living Well Co., a local health coaching business here in Jacksonville. She helps professionals lose weight, reduce stress, improve work performance, and manage chronic health conditions. She is a member of the Jacksonville Chamber of Commerce and a Blue Zone Project School Committee member, and she joins us today. Ms. Ruff, welcome to our program.
Hello, hello, Dr. Servin. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Alejandra, you know it has been a rough week. We've had a hurricane. We've got back to school. We've had some terrible news in the background in Jacksonville. So before we get into all these things, can you just, for the sake of our listeners, define what is a health coach for those that may be uninitiated?
Yeah, so a health coach is somebody who is there to guide you through nutrition and lifestyle changes. So it's not just about prescribing a certain diet. It's about how can you be empowered to make intrinsic choices so that you have long-term results. Because most chronic disease is preventable by nutrition and lifestyle choices. So that is what I am here to do for people.
I'm smiling as our team is all looking. We need you, personally, but that's a different story. So we'll get to that later. We are in back to school times, and it's happening amidst so many things. But let's start us off. What are just some general tips for promoting a healthy back-to-school transition for students?
So first, I would say to be able to get into consistent routine. Students thrive on routine, and so do parents. It's challenging at first because you must work through the growing pains and trial and error after probably not having a routine throughout the summer. But there is light at the end of the tunnel, and you'll get into a good groove in no time. So that means a routine for the mornings. What time do you need to go to bed so that you can wake up well-rested and have enough time to take care of yourself, eat breakfast, and get out the door in time without feeling rushed? Because you bring that sense of feeling rushed throughout your entire day. Then for after school, how much time do you need to unwind and eat so you can be in a headspace for homework? Then homework. When is the best time to do homework so they can be in the present and focus and having a designated spot for it? And then, of course, extracurricular activities, like what do you need to do in order to be able to then have enough time for dinner, then bath and unwinding, so then you can go to sleep early and start all over again in the morning.
I love the concept, but you've brought up a few things. Let's start on the diet and the food part. As a parent, and as I'm sure many parents can identify with, finding a way to get your child to have something nutritious is so hard. How can parents encourage nutritious eating for their kids?
It really is so hard.
How do you do it?
So, believe it or not, children learn eating behaviors from their parents. And one of the best ways that I have even found with my own children is turning food shopping and home cooking into a family affair after school or on the weekends is a great way to then encourage nutritious eating habits. And even though it might seem so much easier to go to the grocery store or cook without them, children learn at the grocery store by smelling, looking, touching, and asking about specific foods. And children who are involved in the shopping process are more likely to eat and then help prepare the food at home. So when they help you in the cooking process, it boosts their confidence, it encourages family bonding, and children naturally learn through hands-on experience. And they're actually more likely to eat what they make.
What about strategies that teachers can use, and in this case, to promote the other side of the health side, which is physical activity and movement in the class? What can teachers do?
Yeah, so first I would say to learn to like physical activity and to have that mindset. So then you can make it a priority throughout the day in between shorter sedentary periods. So then you can set students up for success. Some ideas would be like taking some time every single morning to start the day off with some physical activity, simple standing yoga poses or quick, intense aerobic movement, like maybe, I don't know, running in place or jumping jacks to increase heart rate and give the brain an oxygen boost. Taking a few minutes between lessons for a mini motion break. And one of my favorite things would be to, after lunch, taking a short walk to transition from one activity to another while also getting some fresh air.
Oh, I love that idea. Let me go to yet another one of those difficult topics, and that is going to bed. Are there specific, because I feel like that's just a battle even for the adult, are there specific sleep recommendations for students? And what can we parents and teachers do to help establish those good sleep routines?
The bedtime battles are so real. Even if you try so hard, they still try to fight sleep somehow.
Yes,
sleep is so incredibly important for just overall health and well-being because you need it, right? To stay focused throughout the day, improve your concentration, and improve academic performance. So the American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommends that children aged 6 to 12 years should regularly sleep 9 to 12 hours, and teenagers ages 13 to 18 years old should sleep 8 to 10 hours. I always recommend a good sleep hygiene. So one, most people don't like this one, is to turn electronics off 2 hours before bedtime.
Amen.
Have it completely out of the bedroom. That blue light really suppresses melatonin production and just shifts your circadian rhythm, making it harder to fall and stay asleep. And then prioritize and stick to the same bedtime. If some nights run late due to extracurricular activities or just having a really busy day, prioritize going to bed earlier the following nights. And then, of course, avoiding caffeine, especially after 2 p.m. And that means soda, chocolate, any sort of tea. So it does not disrupt your sleep.
Let me repeat that. So after 2 p.m.
After 2 p.m.
Okay. One of the biggest issues, Alejandra, is just there's so much going on. We just went through a hurricane, a terrible tragedy this week. We're still getting past COVID. What advice do you have for managing stress and anxiety, not just for the students, but the parents, teachers? I just feel it everywhere.
It is everywhere. And one of the first things when it comes to stress and anxiety is to normalize those feelings, because they are completely normal during transitions, during uninvented or events that we weren't expecting, and then change. So change is hard for everyone. So allowing all of those feelings to come and know that it will pass, parents and teachers, they need to put their oxygen masks on first, so that you can be there for the children who are relying on you for all of that emotional support. So like, what does that look like for you? What makes you feel the most present and like your cup is filled? I already spoke about sleep, but sleep is so important to avoid burnout, to be able to focus, be engaged, and to have energy. Eating a whole protein nutrient dense diet. Protein contains chemicals that makes your brain produce neurotransmitters to help regulate your thoughts and your feelings. And then another one that I really truly believe in is to prioritize family meals to connect as much as possible. Maybe it's during breakfast or dinner with absolutely no screens allowed. Eating food should be a mindful experience so you can focus on what you are eating, connecting, having conversations, listening to your body's cues instead of inhaling your food and overeating because you're not paying attention and then just being completely distracted. And throughout hard times, you really need to connect.
And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin. And if you're just joining us, it's back to school time. And we're talking to a local health coach to help prep us for a great academic year. And we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at Jay Servin. Alejandra, COVID is still very much endemic. Flu season is coming close to us, plus whatever other bugs that can circulate. What are the best ways to support immune health to fight the colds, the flu, the COVID, all these things? What are the best ways to support immune health for students?
I'm always probably going to go back to this, but it's eating a nutrient-dense diet that is high in fiber, protein, and plants. Lots of vegetables, because then that gets me into talking about our guts. 70% of our immune system is located in the gut. And nutrition is a key modulator of immune function. So what I mean by that is that the immune cells in the gut interact with the microbiome that is directly influenced by an individual's diet and lifestyle. You can also eat like fermented foods such as sauerkraut, fermented cottage cheese, kimchi, kefir. And then one that might surprise you is exposure to cold, such as cold showers, like a 3-minute cold shower in the morning.
Really?
Or ice face dunk, where you put, like it sounds, ice and water in a bucket and you dunk your head for 20 to 30 seconds because it can induce a temporary increase in your white blood cells, which are the immune cells that are responsible for defending against viruses, bacteria, toxins, and other foreign invaders.
That is so interesting. I love some of these practical tips. Let me get into the issue of the food because, as you said, that's so important. Can you suggest some easy, healthy, packable lunches and snacks for students?
Yeah. So I always have a guide of a fruit, a vegetable, a protein with a healthy fat, and a complex carbohydrate. So for fruit, luckily, children love fruit because it is sweet. So this makes this part easy. You can do kiwi, apples, berries, mango, papaya, peaches, you name it. And try to keep it whole as much as possible instead of canned fruit, because a lot of the canned fruit has a lot of added sugar that we just don't need. Vegetables, cucumbers, celery, tomatoes, sweet peppers, carrots, you are just able to cut them up and put them in the lunchbox very quickly. And then a protein with healthy fat. One of the best ways is to just do leftovers or roll up turkey and some cheese. Add, you know, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich with a jelly that doesn't have that much added sugar. And then a complex carbohydrate. It can be crackers, pretzels, rice cakes. And a little tip would be to try to make it colorful. So if you have a red fruit like an apple, then add a green cucumber just so that you can get a diverse nutrients and vitamins in your diet for the day.
Eat the rainbow, right?
Eat the rainbow. That's right.
One of the other things, Alejandra, is because of the infections that are roaming around, there's always this issue of like, how do we best encourage all of us to do proper hygiene practices to prevent the spread of these bugs?
Yeah. So when it comes to students, as parents, as teachers, as adults, we need to role model it by being consistent. And also by, of course, like washing our hands, then coughing or sneezing onto our elbows, and giving gentle reminders instead of nagging at them or screaming at them to do it. Like, how did you forget to wash your hands? Or how many times do I have to tell you? It's more of like a gentle, consistent reminder so that then it becomes an, oh no, I forgot moment instead of, oh my God, I have to do this again. Why do I have to do this?
One of the things that really stresses people out has to do with the balance question. How you manage time effectively between the schoolwork, the extracurricular activities, social life. What advice can you offer to parents that always talk about this because it's just so hard?
It is really hard because we want to do so many things all at the same time. But first would be to not overschedule. And I know that's really, really hard, but it's figuring out what is the child's and family's priorities. Do they still have time to do homework, spend time with family and friends, get enough sleep? If the answer is no to any of these questions, then it might be too much. So there is no perfect work-life balance and extracurricular balance. It's just managing as you go. Like, some days are just going to be busier than others, but then prioritize for the following days to balance that off. And just know that when you are feeling stressed and burned out, that is your biggest sign to slow down.
Let me go to yet another aspect of healthy living. It is hot outside, and there's so much advice that comes at us about hydration. Can you, number one, tell us how much hydration does the student need, and what strategies do you use to achieve it?
You need about half your body weight in water, which is really hard to do. So I know that keeping a refillable water bottle with you at all times is so important. And also, if you don't seem to have the time to drink all of the water that you need to, eat your water in food, right? With like super hydrating foods in fruits like watermelons, strawberries, melons, pineapple. Most of them contain mostly water. So you can eat your water as well.
There's so much in terms of misinformation out there, and everyone seems to be an expert. What resources do you give to parents or teachers with regards to places that they can go for reliable, good health information related to back to school?
Yeah. So of course I always give them myself because aside from having one-on-one coaching, I have a lot of free resources on social media, all platforms, and also on my website, but also asking your doctor, your primary doctor. They know where to refer you. And if you are a school in Jacksonville, Blue Zones Project just launched in Jacksonville, and they make it so they help you make the healthy choice the easy choice.
One of the things that's very, very common is the issue of mindfulness and self-care practices. How can teachers and parents incorporate this for maybe themselves or for their kids to manage the demands of the school year?
Mindfulness is so important in self-care. So like I mentioned earlier, teachers need to fill up their own cups so that they can be there for others and their students. I always recommend is having a morning routine. Even if you are not a morning person, learn to like it. So those hours between 5 and 7, or even just 5 to 6, you can spend time to sit with yourself in silence. I call it a self-awareness check-in, just doing like a quick body scan. Where are you holding tension? Your body can give you so much information. And also maybe doing some breath work. That will literally set the tone for the day. And then with your students, do you incorporate a moment of just silence? There's so much going on in our lives with the extracurricular activities and school and what's going on in the news. We just need moments of silence.
And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin. And if you're just joining us, it's back to school time. And we're talking to a local health coach to help prep us for a great academic year. And we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at Jay Servin. With regards to issues of just trying to be more resilient or adaptable, do you have any kind of tips that can help parents help their kids be more adaptable and resilient to changes and challenges?
Yes. So with parents, having one-on-one time with each child without distractions. Resiliency comes from relationships. Children need nurturing. And a reliable presence of one supportive relationship helps get kids through tough times. They don't have to be long or even special all of the time. It can be in ordinary times, like when you're in the car, putting your phone away and being present, when you pick them up from school, bath time, car journeys, meals. Chat and listen to talk about the feelings so that they can get in touch and express theirs. And that way you are showing them that you have the space for them to talk about all of the challenges that they have.
You know, one of the realities of our lives these days is the fact that regardless of all the tips and tools, which are absolutely wonderful, there's just a lot of increased family stress, just because everyone is on a different wavelength when it comes to whatever's happened during the day. Do you have any tips or tools that parents can use to foster a harmonious peaceful Zen home environment that supports everyone's emotional health? Am I going for fantasy there? But do you have any tips or tricks?
Yeah, so I mean, I've mentioned some of these a couple of times. I would say, parents, you absolutely need to take care of yourself. I've mentioned that putting your oxygen mask on first, you need to, because otherwise you will feel so drained and depleted that you start to become irritated and snappy, and then it just carries over onto your child. And then screen time, excessive screen time has been linked to stress. So how can you incorporate screen time boundaries at home? Meal times are important. Before bed is important. In the morning, wait an hour at least to look at your phone so that you are not reactive to the world outside of you. You are proactive. And then encouraging maybe 24 hours of no screen once a week, once a month, whatever works for your family, where then you go on, you know, a hike together. You incorporate physical fitness. Maybe you decide to cook a meal together. So you then can start to feel the connection that your family needs. And then you can talk about ways that you guys can improve.
I'm going to let that be our last word. Alejandra, I could sit here and talk to you for hours, because I think sometimes all of us need our own health coach. As I've listened to all your advice, I just want to thank you so much for your wisdom and your time today. I know you're very busy, and just appreciate this. And I'm sure our listeners will appreciate it as well.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I can talk about nutrition and lifestyle all day long.
Well, we are so happy that you're able to kind of share it with us today. We've been talking to Jacksonville local health coach Alejandra Ruff. She is founder and president of Living Well Co. And up next, global health expert Dr. Aaron Berkowitz shares with us how to solve global health problems literally one by one by one. And we'll be right back.
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell, brand new shoes, walking blues, climb the fence, books and pens, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Researchers have found that mindfulness practices can help reduce anxiety, reduce perception of pain, boost creativity, and improve decision making. Eating an apple is healthier and more effective at waking you up in the morning than drinking coffee.
Numbers let us learn to spell, nouns and books and show and tell. Playtime we will throw the ball, back to class, through the hall. Teacher marks our height against the wall.
According to the CDC, a third of U.S. adults report that they usually get less than the recommended amount of sleep. Lack of sleep is linked with many chronic diseases and conditions, such as type 2 diabetes, heart disease, obesity, and depression.
Teacher thinks that I sound funny, but she likes the way you sing. Tonight I'll dream while I'm in bed, when silly thoughts go through my head. About the bugs and alphabet, when I wake tomorrow I'll bet that you and I will walk together again. I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Yes, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and this is What's Health Got to Do with It. You know, as a doctor, I'm surrounded by many health problems daily, which at times floods my attention. It can seem overwhelming to think about addressing the health problems of one person, let alone billions of people. So how exactly do you do that? The answer is by diving into the intricate web of global health with a remarkable voice, making waves in the field. Our next guest is not only an expert in the realm of global health, but us also penned down his insights in a groundbreaking book. With a wealth of experience and knowledge, Dr. Aaron Berkowitz argues for the power of incremental change one person at a time in tackling monumental challenges. His book explores how seemingly small actions and sometimes just one patient can create ripples of transformation in a world teeming with issues. Dr. Aaron Berkowitz is a professor of neurology at the University of California in San Francisco, and his book is One by One, Making a Small Difference Amid a Billion Problems. And he joins us now from San Francisco. Dr. Berkowitz, welcome to our show.
Dr. Servin, thank you so much for having me.
It's so good to have you here. You know, your book, One by One, which is in the title, focuses on making a difference in global health despite overwhelming challenges. Could you share an example, perhaps a poignant example, of how a small effort led to a significant positive impact?
Well, thank you so much for highlighting this book and the work that we did that I discuss in this book. And, you know, the story begins when I had just finished my medical training as a neurologist, and I volunteered to work with an organization called Partners in Health that works to improve medical care in some of the poorest parts of the world. And because I spoke a little French, they sent me to Haiti, where there had been just one neurologist for the entire population of 10 million people. And that neurologist had recently died. So there were no neurologists in the entire country. And one of my first patients there was a young man who had an enormous brain tumor that was so large and having such an effect on his brain that he couldn't walk. He could barely even talk. And so here I was, a brand new doctor, hoping I could help this patient living in a rural area of Haiti with no access to neurologists or neurosurgeons. And thought I could maybe make the first big save of my career. And so working with my colleagues, we brought him to Boston for brain surgery. And without giving too much of the story away, let's just say things don't go quite as planned. And the book is really about the twists and the turns and the triumphs, but also the tragedies and all the confusing spaces in between when a doctor like me from one of the world's richest countries tries to help one patient from one of the world's poorest.
Wow, it sounds so kind of interesting, especially to go to such different healthcare systems from Boston to Haiti. You know, one of the things that often comes up when bringing up huge differences in these healthcare settings is the world is filled, and the U.S. too, with a lot of health disparities. And I'm curious, what inspired you to explore the concept of the incremental change, the one by one, as a tool for addressing these really monumental issues?
Yeah, what a great question and what a challenging question. You know, about 4 billion people in the world don't have access to basic healthcare, let alone the advanced healthcare like neurology and neurosurgery that you and I are involved in. 4 billion, imagine that. It's an astronomical number. It's hard to even make sense of it. But when we convey problems in the billions, we lose sight of the individuals, that billion is made up of 1 billion ones. And when we break these enormous problems down into smaller problems, we get the sense that maybe there's something we can do. Maybe there's some small action we can try to take to make some small change. And as we hear more and more about health inequities and other global problems that they sound so massive and insurmountable, I wanted to tell this story, how I learned how we can each make a small difference in these huge problems, and how each of us can contribute our own small effort, and maybe these small efforts, maybe they too can add up to the billions.
You know, your book emphasizes very much that human element in global health, which I hear loud and clear from how you're speaking to me in terms of touching on one life. Can you elaborate on how personal connections and individual stories shape larger health interventions?
Oh, it's such a great point, Dr. Serban. Public health is often thought of in terms of, well, public, right? It's right there in the name, how we improve the health of communities and societies and countries. And of course, that's all important, but we can't forget that that public, those communities and societies and countries are all made up of individuals like you and me with hopes and dreams and family and friends and wanting to live a healthy life free of disease. And I wanted to tell the stories in this book to put human faces to an often faceless problem and to give voice to people who are often voiceless, and also to tell my story and those of my colleagues who work together to help patients get the neurologic care that they needed but didn't have access to in their country. And, you know, people told us, hey, this isn't cost effective. It's not sustainable trying to treat brain tumors with neurosurgery and radiation and chemotherapy. It'll be so expensive that you could have just built a whole new hospital or vaccinated a whole community. And of course, those things are important, but we still have to face the patient in front of us. Now they've come to that new hospital or they avoided a deadly illness because of a vaccine campaign. And now they're coming with a more complicated problem like a brain tumor. And Paul Farmer, a very inspiring figure in global health who founded Partners in Health, he once said that the chief tension in our work is struggling to serve the patient in front of you through care while simultaneously trying to work to reduce the risk of other patients ending up in front of you through prevention. So we really have to work on both sides of the coin.
Your expertise spans both medical and very much the social realms. How can we bridge the gap between medical interventions and the socioeconomic factors that really influences health outcomes on a global scale? You referenced it just a moment ago, just when you're comparing what you can do for the same amount of money.
Yeah, such an important and challenging point. And that was something I really learned a lot about in our journey to help the patients whose stories I tell in the book. You know, we could bring them to the U.S. for neurosurgery, for chemotherapy, for radiation. We could cure them of their brain tumors, but we learned it's only such a small part of the equation if they return to live in their home country in a situation of dire poverty. And Partners in Health, this very visionary organization, thinks of health much more broadly beyond medicine and surgery. They work to provide their patients with housing and food and employment and all the aspects that go into health beyond just the biomedical aspects.
You know, as someone so deeply involved in these global health initiatives, one of the things that I have noticed with the next generation of medical students is that so many of them want to go out and do some form of global health. And I wondered, what advice do you have for those individuals or these med students who really want to contribute, but sometimes just say, my goodness, this is just so overwhelming because the scale of this is just so massive?
Yeah, it's so daunting, and certainly some people see these problems and say it's just too big. It's too big of a wall to climb. It's too big of a problem to tackle. And that's was really part of my motivation for wanting to write this book and tell these stories. When I was told there was no neurology care in Haiti and I was asked to help, I thought, what can I do as a single neurologist in a country of 10 million people, just as one person? I'm not a public health expert. I'm not a healthcare leader. I'm not an economist. I'm not a legislator. I'm just a neurologist. I only know how to practice my trade, and I don't know how to solve these big problems. And when I got there and asked my colleagues in Haiti, well, what do you think I can do to help? They said, you can teach neurology to our primary care doctors because they're the ones on the front lines practicing neurology, but they've gone to medical school in a country without neurologists. They haven't gotten to learn very much. And if you can just do what you're trained to do here and add that small piece, you're making a contribution that way. And, you know, I saw so many people doing the same thing, not just doctors of all specialties and nurses and public health experts collaborating with our colleagues in Haiti, but plumbers and engineers and building managers using their training to work on improving hospitals and facilities. So it's really an all hands on deck approach. And so when students say, do I need to pick a particular specialty or study a particular area, I think we each have something small we can contribute. And those small contributions can add up to something so much greater than the sum of their parts when we all work together.
Now, your book touches a lot on, as you mentioned, you went to Haiti, but really healthcare in other countries. What has your experiences in other countries taught you about how we should handle health crises and our own disparities here in the U.S.?
It's such a great question. You know, one thing that's always impressed me about Partners in Health and seeing their work in the field and some of these remote and very poor areas of the world is how engaged they are with the local communities. They know the history and the culture and the language, and they work with local leaders to have them run projects and have a truly collaborative approach rather than a top-down one. It's actually right there in their mission statement. They say their work is based on solidarity rather than charity alone. And I think this community-based collaborative model could have a huge impact if applied more broadly. You know, here in the US, we're an enormous and diverse country with countless different communities, each with their own history and culture and different histories of interaction with the healthcare system. And so I think it's really working directly with communities and empowering them with the resources they request and supporting them to carry out the work they want to do to serve their communities, because they really know best.
Dr. Berkowitz, can you share a pivotal moment from your own personal journey in global health that really has reinforced your belief in the power of the individual, small actions, to effect a lasting change for someone?
Well, that hits right to the heart of another reason I really wanted to write this book. You know, time and time again, I found that although I can't fix any of the really huge problems that we're wrestling with through these stories, health inequities and poverty, I learned that many of us working together in small ways can make a small dent, or what might seem like a small dent to us, but that's extraordinarily impactful for the patients themselves and their families. And as I tell in the stories in this book, we were able to get a few patients to the U.S. for neurosurgery, and it really transformed their lives. I tell one story in the book, for example, of a young boy who developed complete paralysis of his arms and legs due to a tumor in his spine. This young five-year-old boy could only move his head, his eyes, he could talk, but he was completely paralyzed. And with incredible care by neurosurgeons at Boston Children's Hospital, they removed a tumor in his spine. He was completely cured. His parents still send me pictures. He's playing sports. He actually even wants to be a doctor when he grows up. And, you know, in the face of public health and problems that rank in the millions and billions, people might say, well, it's a small victory to help a single patient, but you're not solving the larger problems. But there are larger problems to solve. But to that patient and his family, that was their largest problem, and helping to solve it really meant everything to them.
Yeah, when I think about it, for that one person, that's their entire world.
Yes.
It's impressive. Wow. Your book also offers a very fresh perspective on tackling health issues collaboratively. You're talking about teams, finding other folks that you work with to help with. Can you delve a little bit into that concept of partnership-driven approaches? And how could that improve or reshape the landscape of global health?
Such a great point, Dr. Servin. You know, Partners in Health works in what they call an accompaniment model. And so when working in a poor region, a U.S.-based organization that may decide to work in that region certainly brings a lot of financial resources and technical expertise, but none of this can be effectively utilized without a strong collaboration with the local community and the local experts for us to learn from each other how best we can work together to have an impact. And Paul Farmer said in one of his wonderful speeches, which you can find online, that we have to move the global health field from the idea of aid to the idea of accompaniment. And that when policies fail, it's often not because of policies or projects failing. They fail because there's not accompaniment. They fail not in the idea, but in the implementation, if there's no collaboration with the local community. So this accompaniment collaborative model is really at the heart of their work. And I've learned so much from my colleagues in Haiti and elsewhere in the world from how they work in some of the most difficult circumstances with some of the most limited resources. And as I said earlier, I was asked to go to Haiti to teach neurology, but I've learned an extraordinary amount. And part of what I wanted to share in this book are some of the incredible lessons I've learned from my colleagues there and their work to take care of their patients.
That's fascinating to me, because in some ways it sounds you may have all this knowledge come from these great institutions to go to a poor place, but you almost still have to show humility to what you can learn from it.
Absolutely.
You know, I know you teach med students and you help in these global health endeavors. As you look ahead, what would be your vision that you'd share with your students or students that are listening to this show regarding global health in the future?
Oh, thanks for asking. That's a very important question. You know, I think all students, not just students with a particular interest in global health and health equity, need their medical education to include not just biomedical science and clinical skills, but really understanding the social determinants of health, the many aspects of any society, local or global, that contribute to health and disease. And we can't learn these from a book. They have to be learned in the community and from the community in which the students are learning in medical school and serving patients. And this issue of global health and equity is present everywhere, not just when people think globally, they think outside of the U.S., but in cities and rural areas here in the U.S. as well as abroad. So there's plenty of so-called global work to do here at home too in our communities facing health inequities. And the other thing, as I mentioned earlier, you know, students often will ask, Paul Farmer was an infectious disease specialist. Do I need to be an infectious disease specialist? Or I've seen students ask, you know, should I be a surgeon? Because then I know I can go and I can practice my trade of surgery. And it's truly, as I mentioned earlier, an all hands on deck approach. Students should find what they're most interested in, and they will definitely be needed. When I first got started in global health, there were hardly any neurologists, and it wasn't clear to me what the path was. And a mentor of mine fortunately said, well, maybe the fact that there's no neurologist expresses the need, not that there is not a path for it. Because I too wondered, should I be like Paul Farmer and become an infectious disease specialist? And I've worked with everyone from pathologists to radiologists to primary care doctors. And the truth is, from primary care to surgery, generalists, subspecialists, we need all hands on deck, and everyone can contribute in their own way to improving health equity.
Dr. Berkowitz, in our last moment here, to those who are not practicing medicine, they're listening and yet still interested, what advice do you have for the public as they hear about global health initiatives in general? What would you want them to take away from your book and your stories?
Oh, well, thanks for asking that question. You know, there's so much work to be done. And as I mentioned, one of the things I learned in Haiti was that it wasn't just doctors and nurses contributing to improving healthcare. It was plumbers and engineers and building specialists and project managers and people from all different trades and crafts and professions working to work with local colleagues to help with training or help provide resources or other ways of helping develop local expertise and continuing those collaborations over time. And yet, some people might not be able to serve in the field. And with the virtual era now, many people can serve online. I have colleagues in neurology, for example, who, and myself included, who help with consultation, medical consultation through telemedicine and resource-limited areas where there are no specialists. And some may just want to support this type of work without getting directly involved. And of course, organizations like Partners in Health and others like it would not be able to function if not for the generous support of donors who listen to important reporting like yours, Dr. Servin, and say they'd like to get involved and help in some way. And there are ways of contributing as well to organizations that do the type of work that inspires people to contribute and donate so that they can continue doing that good work.
Dr. Berkowitz, I want to thank you so much for giving us your time today. I know you are extremely busy. Godspeed. God bless you really for the work that you do. It's so amazing. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Dr. Servin, thanks so much for having me. It was wonderful to speak with you, and I'm so grateful that you were interested in the book and highlighted it for your listeners.
Appreciate it. We've been talking to Dr. Aaron Berkowitz. He is a professor of neurology at the University of California in San Francisco, and he has an amazing book called One by One, Making a Small Difference Amid a Billion Problems. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Lutkin. Heather Schatz is our senior producer. Miriam Ganas is our director. Stacy Bennett is our producer. Next week's program is on concussions as the Jags and high school students all around get ready for football. We're also talking about health misinformation. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tweet me at jservin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening. Happy Labor Day, and stay in touch.
Drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go. Into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go. Hail, hail, rock and roll. Deliver me from the days of old. The drums loud and bold. Rock, rock, rock and roll. Feeling is there, body and soul. Rock, rock, rock and roll. Feeling is there, body and soul.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And by the Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today.